You are listening to the best of the Dennis Prager Show. Hi, everybody, and welcome to the Dennis Prager Show. If there has been a mesmerizing figure in the last couple of years, it has to be Bernie Madoff, the man who swindled people out of approximately $65 billion. And I have been waiting, to be honest, with bated breath to have the book that would describe what he did. And it is finally out, The Wizard of Lies, a terrific title, actually. The Wizard of Lies, Bernie Madoff and the Death of Trust. The author is Diana Henriquez, and she is senior financial writer for the New York Times, a winner of the Polk Award, a Pulitzer Prize finalist, and so on. And she has written, again, The Wizard of Lies. May I call you Diana?
Of course.
Well, welcome to the Dennis Prager Show.
I'm glad to be here.
Thank you very much. I have so much I want to ask you. Let me tell you, let me emote for a moment. And if you feel what I said is absurd, my listeners know I have no problem with being told that.
Okay.
Believe it or not, I have very, very strong standards of right and wrong, as my listeners know, and I have no problem in saying that there really do exist bad people on this earth, just as I really believe there exist good people, for reasons that I can't fully articulate. I don't find him as hateable as I want to find him. Does that make any sense to you?
It does. And in fact, if that was a product of reading The Wizard of Lies, I feel like I've accomplished something of what I wanted to accomplish, Dennis, because to some extent, the belief that people have about Ponzi schemers in particular, it's a peculiar crime. We can talk about that in a minute. But the belief that people have that there's going to be some kind of natural detestability about these folks is a dreadful falsehood, and it leaves us all vulnerable to the next Bernie Madoff. Ponzi schemers are always attractive, trusted people, and because there is really no pain until the music stops, this is the crime of the egotist, not the sadist. He's not trying to inflict pain on people the way so many vicious criminals do. So I think it is helpful, and you are, in fact, quite wise to think about a Ponzi schemer, and he was the ultimate Ponzi schemer, to think about him in a slightly different way.
And I'll tell you, interestingly, among the reasons is, first, I did interview, ironically, I don't know how it occurred, but it just did, I interviewed the author of a biography of Ponzi. And Ponzi himself didn't set out to hurt everybody, and turned out to be a particularly kind man who gave his own skin in skin grafts to a total stranger. It was an amazing story about that man, and I guess that was one reason. The other is, tell me about this. Couldn't he have pled innocent or not guilty and extended this thing God knows how long?
And there was a good bit of surprise about why he didn't. In fact, his defense lawyer tells me that that is the first question anyone asks him at any country club gathering is, why did you let him plead guilty so quickly? He could have dragged this out, and we'd still be waiting for the trial.
Yes, and he would be a free man.
He was locked up in his penthouse, but certainly he would not be in a federal prison in Butner. And when I asked him that question, when I visited him in the federal prison in August, the first of the two visits that I made with him, his reaction was, by your lights also, an act of kindness. He could see what this media frenzy was doing to his family. And he said he simply thought that if he pleaded guilty quickly, got it over with, admitted his crime, took his medicine, paid the price, that the pressure on his family would ease somehow. Now, he thoroughly miscalculated. I think the way his family was treated was one of the few things about all of this that totally blindsided him. He was utterly unprepared for it. But what he explained to me, and his lawyer confirmed it, was that they had these long discussions about what would happen if he played it out, as you suggested. You know, if he pleaded not guilty, waited for trial, all the discovery, and so forth. And Madoff just could not subject his family to that, which is why he acted as he did. Now, as we can see in hindsight, the fact that he pleaded guilty and was sentenced and was locked up did not reduce the pressure on his family members one bit, but he certainly thought it would.
Do you mean legal pressure or press pressure?
Well, the legal pressure was inevitable. They have been sued. The entire Madoff family has been sued by the trustee attempting to gather assets. That's the trustee's job. Those lawsuits are going through the bankruptcy court. They've been sued by many of the victims who think that they may be able to recover money from Madoff family now that Madoff himself is locked up. So there's a great deal of civil litigation that they were facing. But the public scorn, the public vilification, the outright open accusations that they were all his accomplices. At a public gathering I attended, Dennis, someone, a very well-known media person, referred to them as an organized crime family. Mm. Now, this was absent any proof whatsoever that Ruth, Mark, or Andrew Madoff were in any way involved in Bernie Madoff's fraud. So that pressure on the internet, it was particularly virulent. In fact, the day that Mark Madoff finally broke under this weight of suspicion and shame and committed suicide on the second anniversary of his father's arrest, a particularly long-standing critic of the family posted a message that said, "One down, three to go."
Wow.
So the
I have to say that to me is more sadism than anything that Madoff had in his own being.
Well, it's an understandable reaction in a way. I mean, you and I both see how angry people get, and you I'm sure remember those meltdown days of late 2008 and the fury that people had towards the folks that they saw as dragging us into this dreadful ditch. So I understand it. And it must be quickly said that Madoff did a devastating amount of personal damage. He ruined families. Two other investors committed suicide in the aftermath of his arrest when they discovered that they were ruined. Beloved homes had to be sold. College educations had to be aborted. There was a trail of devastation as far as the eye could see, literally stretching from Palm Beach to the Persian Gulf because of his crime.
I'm just talking about a person to publicly say one down, two to go. I now hope that the other brother and the mother commit suicide. That is an act to me of sadism. I mean, that's cruel. That's just cruel.
It is, there was a great deal of cruelty aimed at them. This person was not even a victim. I mean, you know, this is somebody who has an opinion on the internet. So that kind of attitude was not uncommon. You know, in my business, these are what are referred to as libel-proof people. You can really say anything you want to about Ruth, Mark, and Andrew Madoff because they can't take you to court. They can't hold you to account.
Right.
They couldn't even get a correction run.
By the way, did you meet them as well?
Well, you know, everyone I interviewed on the record, Dennis, and you know how this goes, everyone I interviewed on the record is identified in the books. It's well-sourced, as you know. It's 50 pages of notes. If someone isn't identified by name in the book, it's either because they declined to talk to me or because they agreed to talk to me only under ground rules of confidentiality. And it wouldn't be fair to either group to start, you know, naming names and picking people about.
The only reason
I did a great deal of research into the dynamics of the Madoff family because I felt it was central to the human drama of the story.
Well, the reason that I asked really was to know, were you surprised by the son's suicide?
Oh, gosh, I will never forget getting that call from the office at the early hours of a Saturday morning and hearing the news that there was a police report about his suicide. At the moment, of course, I was shocked. But as I began to work on the story and prepare our story for the paper the next day and then a profile of him for the following week, No, I can't really say I was surprised. It was a dreadful burden to carry, and Mark was a young man who had always taken enormous pride in being Bernie Madoff's son. Madoff was one of the most respected men on the back streets of Wall Street. You know, he was a wholesale stock trader. Retail customers probably had never heard of him, but I had. I knew how important he was to the structure of Wall Street, the automation of the stock market. And he built this business from scratch. He founded the business as a college senior.
Okay, hold on with that point. Business. We're going to continue in a moment. Diana Henriques, The Wizard of Lies, Bernie Madoff, and the Death of Trust, up at DennisPrager.com. Dennis Prager here, and I am speaking with Diana Henriques, H-E-N-R-I-Q-U-E-S. She is a senior financial writer for the New York Times and has written what is certainly now the definitive work on Bernie Madoff, The Wizard of Lies. Great term, as I said earlier, Bernie Madoff and the Death of Trust. And Diana, we were talking about the family, and I have to say I look upon this whole thing as a Shakespearean or Greek tragedy. Especially
it
with this.
It struck me that way too, frankly. And
yes.
I think that's what made it so enduringly fascinating to people, was that human dimension.
We were talking
about how Mark had gotten all of his source of pride in being his father's son, and then when Madoff was arrested, it became his greatest shame. And, you know, those issues of shame and humiliation and pride, they are the big Greek. Big Greek tragic myths. It's a huge human drama.
I'm a father, and I have two sons, and I think they take some pride in me. And
I'm sure they do.
Thank you. But I, being a father, I thought about this, and I thought there is no nightmare I can conceive of that could equal my shaming my sons, and. So it helps explain what I asked you. Why would at least one of the sons take his life? Because the father went from hero to villain so quickly.
In a heartbeat. They were gathered in a beautiful study in the penthouse apartment, wood paneled walls, tapestry furniture, all gathered around there. And in the matter of 5 minutes, less than 5 minutes, according to Madoff, he tells his sons and his wife that it's all a fraud. It has all been a lie. Everything you thought you knew about this man you admired and loved and respected, it is phony. It's unreal. You know, I've had something similar like that happen to me in my life. Many people have been disillusioned, and you feel the ground kind of drop out from under you. But this was a devastating experience for them. And Andrew came through it better than Mark did. He always had a little bit more of a life outside the firm than his older brother did. And I think that stood him in good stead. But Mark was just utterly destroyed.
And what about the wife when she heard it?
Stunned, from all I can tell, and I have talked with Madoff several times about that particular experience, that little half-hour session that they had. She was stunned. And Madoff, when I interviewed him in prison the first time, that was the only point at which he lost his own composure. He actually started to weep when I asked him whether he regretted that Ruth had stayed with him after his arrest. It was a decision that many of her friends criticized. It was a decision certainly that opened her up to a great deal of public vilification. He said he had told her she should leave. Her friends had told her she should leave. But he said she somehow found enough compassion for me to stay. And that gave me an insight, really, into their relationship. She met him when she was 13 years old and fell in love with him at first sight. He was a 16-year-old lifeguard, bronzed, handsome. And she married him when she was 18. She thought he walked on water. A friend of theirs said that the only person who thought more of Bernie Madoff than Ruth was Bernie Madoff himself. But she absolutely adored him. And she was shattered to discover what he'd done. But at the same moment, he was shattered by what had happened. And she just couldn't walk away from him. So it was an interesting long time love affair, 50 plus years, that ended in this utter nightmare for her, followed by, as you say, the loss of her older son. The Madoff family is a tragic example of how much harm Madoff's crime did.
That's exactly right. Whatever harm he had done to others, why did I never quite followed? And I'm not saying that I can ever quite follow any given suicide, but what goes on in people's hearts and minds is
very true.
Is so their own, but still. You mentioned that there were two others who had committed suicide. Tell me about them.
Yes, in the just a few weeks after Madoff's arrest, an aristocratic French investor, Terry Delavillehouchet, locked himself in his office and inflicted cuts on his arm with a box cutter, set a little trash can by his chair to catch the blood, and bled to death overnight after having lost more than $1 billion of his investors' money, $50 million of his own money in the Madoff scheme. Madoff, a man he and his partner had trusted for decades. He was devastated by the humiliation of having betrayed and failed his customers. A few months later, a retired British military man who had expected to retire on his savings in civilian life, had invested his savings with a fund operated out of Vienna by Bank Medici, one of the big Madoff feeder funds. He'd never heard of Bernie Madoff, but he tried to get some of his money out of his account and learned, to his horror, that he was a Madoff victim. He hadn't even known it. He took his service revolver to a park near his home and shot himself. So these were people whose lives were utterly, completely ruined. Their families were bereaved. There's no amount of money or recovery through bankruptcy that can ever put those lives back together again.
When did it start? This is probably the question most people wonder about. Did the man wake up one day and say, you know, I'm pretty good at fraud, and I really think I can live the life of Riley for decades? I don't believe that that's the way the mind works. How did it start?
You're right that is the greatest mystery. In fact, it was the first question I asked Madoff when I sat down with him in prison. When did it start? I'm not sure he told me the truth. In fact, I'm pretty certain he didn't. He insisted it didn't start until early 1990s, 1992, he said. I don't think that's credible at all. I explain in the book why I feel that way. I think it had to have been in operation at least some level by the mid-1980s. I lay out a number of reasons drawn from a great deal of research that leads me to believe that. There are some people who think it was a fraud from the beginning. I'm not quite sure that the evidence is there to support that. Certainly, Madoff had a very early experience with having to decide between telling the truth and telling a lie. Back in 1962, he'd invested his clients' money, mostly friends and family money, in some very speculative high-risk stocks. They blew up, and he'd lost all his clients' money, and rather than tell them, he lied to them about it. He covered up their losses, bought the shares back,
so
and
he had
let them
practice.
Think that they were made whole. So he had always been unable to admit failure.
All right, hold on there. Just keep that thought in mind. The Wizard of Lies, Bernie Madoff and the Death of Trust, New York Times financial writer Diana Henriquez. Book up at DennisPrager.com. We continue. I welcome you back. I am speaking to New York Times financial writer Diana Henriquez. The book, The Wizard of Lies, Bernie Madoff and the Death of Trust. And the book is considered to be as riveting as she is as an interview.
Thanks, Dennis.
No, it's and the subject, I almost envy you. I both envy you and feel bad because the element of tragedy on every level with everyone concerned is so great. It's not the happiest immersion of an author's time.
It wasn't, but you know, every journalist has a dream of the novel in the desk drawer. You know, someday you're gonna write that story. Well, I can tick that off my list because this was like a novel, but it was all real. I couldn't have created better characters for telling this timeless story of betrayal.
So I asked you when it began, and you mentioned in the 60s he had already been involved in shady dealings and could not acknowledge that.
Yes, he covered up losses that he inflicted on his clients and let them think he was a genius, and that sort of lay the groundwork for what came forward. But I think that when the markets cooperated and allowed him to earn good returns for his investors without cheating, he did. But when the markets turned against him and he could no longer do that, rather than say, you know, listen, guys, I can't make that kind of money for you anymore. I can't achieve those consistent returns. He was never a big, promise you the moon and stars investors. He just promised you nice, consistent returns. And when he could no longer do that, rather than admit it, he started stealing to sustain the returns. And like every Ponzi schemer, he said he believed he would be able to work his way out of it. He would only have to temporarily steal a little money, but he couldn't. And soon he was in the hole by billions of dollars and gave up any hope of ever being able to get back on the straight and level again.
Did you ask him, how did you sleep every night?
I did. And his answer was not unsurprising to me because I think it is the answer any Ponzi schemer would give you. A Ponzi scheme is a very strange crime. There is no pain until it stops. You know, there are no victims, actually, until the Ponzi scheme falls apart. So when he looked at his friends, his family, his investors, he didn't see victims. He saw beneficiaries. They were benefiting from the returns he was paying them, from the consistency he was giving them. It was only at the end, when it all started to spin apart, that he began to see them as his victims. And as you noted, he at that point tried to make some amends with the couple of $100 million that were still in his command by sending out checks to friends and neighbors and investors, trying to cash out their accounts before the whole house of cards came tumbling down.
What was in it? It seems to me that what was in it for him was avoiding disgrace more than the opulence of a life rich style, or am I being too kind to him?
Well, you're being, I think, insightful, because this was a man who had built a successful, legitimate business. I mean, he lived very well for many years on the strength of his legitimate business. And even the trustee who has, in the bankruptcy case, who has sued people to recover money, has only put the tab for the immediate Madoff family at about $250 million. So that's the amount that he argues Madoff skimmed out of the fraud for his own benefit. Well, compared to $65 billion in paper profits and at least $20 billion in cash outlays, that's a rather modest level. The Madoffs did not live excessively high on the hog, as we would say. He, compared to the world he operated in, the hedge fund world on Wall Street, they drew no attention to themselves by the lavishness or elaborateness of their lifestyle, although it's certainly a lovely lifestyle that many of us would envy. Most money in a Ponzi scheme is used to keep the Ponzi scheme going. Yeah. It comes in the door, it goes out the door. And that's what happened to most of the money here.
All right. A lot more to ask you, including, why didn't anybody figure this out? This is probably question number two that would be on everybody's mind. The book is The Wizard of Lies. Diana Henriquez of the New York Times has written it. Bernie Madoff and the Death of Trust. This Greek and other form of tragedy that we're talking about. Back in a moment. I'm Dennis Prager. And let me tell you this, folks. If Bernie Madoff had attended Prager University, he wouldn't have done this. But, of course, he well precedes the creation of Prager University, and you are invited to visit on the Internet. My guest is Diana Henriquez, and she is a senior financial writer for the New York Times, and she has written this remarkable book, The Wizard of Lies, Bernie Madoff and the Death of Trust. And I'm just, again, I use the word advisedly and honestly riveted by everything you have to say. Everybody wants to know the answer to this. How could so many people be fooled? These are not dummies that he was investing for some of the biggest hedge funds.
He was.
Right. So what gives?
Well, I think he is a monument to our capacity for self-deception, without a doubt. People wanted to believe in the story he was telling them, and the story was safe, low, consistent returns in up markets and in bad. It's the Holy Grail. We all want it. We wanted to believe that he could deliver it. And people were willing to trust his reputation, to trust his track record, and not demand that he provide them with the kind of documentation and the kind of safety practices that they would have required of someone they didn't trust. Now, obviously, there were regulators who should have caught this. There's no doubt about it. There were whistleblowers who tried to blow the whistle on Madoff, and they weren't listened to. But it's way too simplistic to just to say that they're the villains here, because this was an extraordinarily well camouflaged fraud. Madoff even kept a stash of old stationery so that he could backdate old documents and stick them in the files if he knew regulators would look for them. They had computer software that would reconstruct what looked like an independent clearinghouse account showing all your stocks and bonds safely there, when in fact it was all phony. So he took great pains to make sure that both investors, the fancy hedge fund managers and their due diligence lawyers, and his regulators all saw exactly what they expected to see when they came to visit. And he always had this air about him, Dennis, that, you know, look, you have questions, you have suspicions, fine, take your money. I don't want it. Take it. And that, of course.
Right, and nobody wanted to do that. Exactly. So that begs the obvious next question, and that is, what did everybody working with him do? Push pencils?
Well, there was a small core of people who worked on his actual money management business. He had automated it. I mean, this is not surprising. The Madoff firm was known on the street for the sophistication of its stock trading automation. He actually used automation to help automate his Ponzi scheme as well, so that it did not take enormous numbers of people to send out these thousands of statements and so forth. There are criminal charges pending, Dennis, against five people who worked for his number two henchman, Frank DiPasquale, who has pleaded guilty to his role in this crime. Those five defendants have insisted that they are innocent. They will go to trial later this year. And, you know, my starting position is innocent until proven guilty. So that's
all right. Well, that's all right. That's
to make it.
That's a legal view. What is your non-binding legal view? Do you believe others knew?
I think whether or not it is these particular others, I think there certainly had to be a core of people around Frank DiPasquale who helped sustain this. It is the government's obligation to prove that it got the right people, but it's hard for me to believe that the sheer mechanics of keeping this going could have been concealed between just Frank and Bernie all of those years. I lay out in my book who I think did what and who's been accused of what, but certainly the paperwork that sustained this over time, while it was automated, it still required some human input. Frank DiPasquale was a critical figure, absolutely critical. Who else helped him? That's going to have to be proven in the courts, but we know other people did.
Do you think law, ethics, or morality demands that those who made money from the fund give money to those who lost?
Oh, that's one of the most heartbreaking aspects of a Ponzi scheme, Dennis. You know, a typical crime transfers wealth from the victim to the villain. a Ponzi scheme, you know, transfers wealth from one victim to another victim. Mm-hmm. And putting it back together again is painful. I mean, if you rob Peter to pay Paul, how do you reverse it? How do you fix it? You know, you take it back from Peter and take it back from Paul and give it to Peter. So that is part of the awful calculus of the Ponzi scheme. I don't necessarily pick right and wrong. I do know it is a fascinating legal issue, and it's going to shape law for all of us for decades to come, the outcome of this case. It's before the federal appellate court now.
I don't know enough about this aspect of the law, and I'm not sure anybody does. It may, as you say, may be new law. But on moral grounds, I don't know why, if I pulled out my money, I am obligated to pay those who didn't.
Well, if you pulled out only the money you put in, you aren't obligated to pay those who didn't.
I've pulled out stolen money.
And then $500,000 in what you thought were legitimate profits,
right,
but which were actually my $500,000 that I just gave Bernie. So that's where it gets so heartbreaking. You know, if everyone just got back what they paid, what they gave to Bernie, they'd all be on a level playing field. But what has happened, because this crime went on for so long, what happened was people who put in $1 million over time took out that $1 million in profits, and then another $1 million in profits, and then another $1 million in profits. Well, that second $2 million was money that Bernie stole from two other people who thought they had invested $1 million each. So how do you get that back? How do you unwind it? It's just a heartbreaking tangle of litigation.
Final segment coming up with Diana Henriquez, New York Times financial writer, the book The Wizard of Lies, on every human and every other level. The story is just so compelling. Bernie Madoff and the death of trust. I'll ask about the death of trust. I don't know, and I don't even know if it's a good thing. We should never have a death of trust, but maybe we do. Back in a moment. I'm Dennis Prager. Dennis Prager here, and I'm speaking with the person who may well have the most knowledge of Bernie Madoff, the family, and the scheme of anyone living, period. Diana Henriquez, The Wizard of Lies, Bernie Madoff and the Death of Trust. The book is up at DennisPrager.com. She is a senior financial writer for the New York Times. And it's gone so fast. I mean, there's so much to talk about. Do you have any thoughts on the New York Mets issue with the Bernie Madoff?
Well, if you told me that we'd still be wrestling with that issue this long after the case, here we are 2.5 years out. The Mets clearly are in a difficult business situation, and they were within a few weeks of Madoff's arrest. The Wilpon family interests, which own the Mets, the New York Mets, had a cash crisis very soon after that arrest because they were so dependent upon their Madoff accounts for the day-to-day liquidity that they used for payroll and for paying the bills. And so the notion of whether or not they knew they were participating in a Ponzi scheme, to me, is wrong-headed. Nobody would leave themselves that vulnerable to a 71-year-old Ponzi schemer if you knew that's what he was doing. So that's not the issue. The issue is, can they satisfy the demands of the bankruptcy trustee to return the amount he's seeking without having to sell the team? And that's something that they are fighting very aggressively. I will say that they've kind of picked up the standard for the Madoff victims who are fighting against the clawbacks, as they call them, of the trustee's efforts to take money back from the people who thought they were taking legitimate profits out. And they're being very aggressive in the courts. They're being very aggressive in the realm of public relations as well. But there is a great deal hanging on how that lawsuit turns out, including ultimately their ability to hang on to that team.
Right. Well, let me ask you one final question, you having met Bernie Madoff. Is there a part of you that thinks that there is a part of him that thinks that he will have to answer to a God?
Oh, that's a wonderful question, Dennis. You know, there's one guy I've mentioned, had this discussion with, said, you know, he must believe that there is a heaven and a hell because he's in hell now. And after the death of his son and the destruction of his family and the absolute destruction of his reputation, he may feel that yes, there's a hell and he's in it. He and his family were as an older man, was never particularly observant with his faith. His brother was. Peter Madoff was very devout, and so maybe Bernie is beginning to address eternal verities.
Well, let me just say this. My belief is he got the right writer, and it's the greatest compliment I can pay you.
Oh, bless your heart, Dennis. Thank you so much.
You're very welcome. Thank you so much. The book, The Wizard of Lies, up at DennisPrager.com.